President Biden delivers a fiery State of the Union address in what may be the most consequential speech in his bid for re-election.
I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation. Between those who want to pull America back to the past and those who want to move America into the future.
Concerns grow as hopes fade for a ceasefire hostage release deal in Gaza.
We fear that this already catastrophic situation may slide deeper into the abyss as many Palestinians mark the holy month of Ramadan, a period that is meant to honor peace and tolerance.
And what climate scientists say could be on the horizon for some of the planet's most important ecosystems. Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello there, I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden used his third State of the Union speech Thursday night to announce a dramatic measure to facilitate aid into Gaza, to push funding for Ukraine's war efforts, and warn the country of the threat posed by Donald Trump, his likely opponent in the November election, as he made his case for re-election in 2024. Reuters reporter Gabe Singer sums it up.
U.S. President Joe Biden came out swinging against Donald Trump and Republicans in his State of the Union address on Thursday.
My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that.
He accused Trump and the GOP of trying to rewrite history about the January 6th Capitol riot by the former president's supporters.
You can't love your country only when you win.
It was one of a series of fiery attacks in Biden's hour-long speech touching on abortion, the economy, and the war in Gaza, to contrast himself with his competition in November's general elections as he seeks to overcome his currently low approval ratings. That included accusing Trump, who he never directly named, as, quote, bowing down to Russia.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. That's a quote. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable.
Biden also accused Trump of torpedoing a bill to tighten restrictions at the U.S. border with Mexico. He also emphasized support of the NATO Security Alliance. Sweden's prime minister was in the audience after his country formally joined NATO earlier in the day. Among other guests, people affected by the Alabama Supreme Court's ruling over embryos, which prompted several IVF providers there to halt the procedure. Biden highlighted their stories and traced them back to the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade.
If you, the American people, send me a Congress that supports the right to choose, I promise you, I'll restore Roe v. Wade as the law of the land again.
The president faces criticism from progressives over support for Israel and its war against Hamas, and Republicans for his stance on immigration. While Democrats mostly lauded his speech with cheers and applause, many wore ceasefire pins. Biden sought to cool anger in his party and on the left. He sharply criticized Israel's leaders, calling on them not to hold up humanitarian aid to Gaza, and announced that the U.S. military will build a pier on Gaza's coast to boost aid.
No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day.
The speech was a key opportunity for Biden to reach voters weighing whether to vote for him, choose Trump, or sit out the election. Trump appeared to lash out over Biden's fiery rhetoric on his Truth Social platform, saying, quote, the anger and shouting is not helpful to bringing our country back together. Opinion polls show them closely matched in the race, with many American voters unenthusiastic about the rematch.
And now for analysis on the president's address, we're joined by Robert Boatwright, Clark University professor of political science.
He had in some ways, a tough challenge ahead of him. That is, he could have spoken very coherently for almost the entire thing. And if there had been one moment where he really fumbled, you know, he got some facts wrong, he got something else like that wrong, that would potentially have been the story. On the other hand, I think there has been so much talk about his stamina, his physical well-being and all of that, that you could also respond and say, well, he just had to show up and talk for a while and he might soothe some of those concerns. So what he said is actually a little bit less important in a lot of ways than just the fact that he was able to put together a combative, feisty, kind of lively speech.
So that really stood out to you as his demeanor than necessarily the things he was saying?
He did put together a speech that in some ways had clearly been well thought out. There were accounts before the speech that he had been meeting with historians, that he wanted to frame what he was doing in the context of speeches that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had given or speeches that Ronald Reagan had given. And that was there if you listen closely, but that's not really the takeaway, right? The takeaway has to do with the fact that he was able to talk over the people that heckled him and that he was able to engage in a sort of lively banter, I guess, with everybody in the room.
Did the speech, in your view, seem more political than past State of the Unions by presidents?
Absolutely. That's one of the unusual things about this speech. It is pretty unprecedented to have the president deliver the State of the Union address this late. He was giving this speech after Super Tuesday. Whatever lingering doubts people might have had about the Republican primary were over with by the time of the speech. So it's pretty unusual for a president to have the opportunity to give the State of the Union as really the kickoff to his campaign. I'm not sure that was something that was arranged by the Speaker of the House. The Speaker of the House invites the president to come and talk at a particular time. I don't know what was going on in Speaker Johnson's mind, why he picked this particular date. But in that regard, Republicans in the House basically gave him the opportunity to kickstart his campaign in this nationally televised forum. We've gone over in the space of a decade or so from having State of the Union speeches be this very, very serious, august kind of thing to really expecting theatrics on the part of people in the audience. And so I think what made this unusual is that in the past, when these things have happened, they were so unexpected that they really knocked the president off his game, or at least they became the story. If you go back to the Barack Obama State of the Union, where the congressman from South Carolina interrupted him to yell at him, that was unusual, and people paid a lot of attention to it, and Obama responded, but he clearly didn't expect it. I think what we saw is that Biden was prepared to talk over whatever was happening in the House. You could hear these sort of mumblings and so on, but he was aware that he was the guy with the microphone. Right? He was the one who got to talk, and that if he didn't respond to his hecklers, nobody would pay attention. But on the other hand, what you saw is that he was prepared to talk back to them.
And what did you take away from the Republican response?
That was quite a speech. The responses have really gone over the past couple of decades from being a very serious moment when the person who is kind of the leader of the opposition gives an alternative view, where, say, the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader gets up and gives a very solemn account of party goals, to these kind of odd events where junior lawmakers in the other party get an opportunity to make a name for themselves. And I think in general, they have been failures. Marco Rubio, for instance, famously a few years ago, gave a response, and the only thing people remembered was that there was this awkward moment where he stopped to have a drink of water. So there's really no upside to the people giving those. But I think what was really striking about this one is that it was a speech that was full of these sort of Republican talking points. You know, America is this incredibly dangerous place, stuff like that, that will strike a lot of people as being untrue, but play very much into this sort of narrative that people who are really heavily into this sort of alternate media universe that many Trump supporters are in would recognize. It was very interesting that she declined to mention Ukraine in the speech. She made a vague reference to Putin's aggression towards Europe, but she said it in a very strange way, as if she were trying to avoid mentioning Ukraine. And the same thing with the talk about the Middle East.
Robert Boatwright, professor of political science at Clark University, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Hopes are dwindling for a ceasefire and hostage release deal ahead of the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office sounded the alarm over the catastrophic situation in Gaza, particularly if Israel expands its offensive into the border town of Rafah.
We are entering the sixth month of a brutal conflict that has destroyed the lives and homes of countless Palestinians as well as Israelis. We fear that this already catastrophic situation may slide deeper into the abyss as many Palestinians mark the holy month of Ramadan, a period that is meant to honour peace and tolerance. Should Israel launch its threatened military offensive into Rafah, where 1.5 million people have been displaced in deplorable subhuman conditions.
Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who called an immediate end to the conflict and said the killing and destruction must stop.
The hostages, who have now endured over 150 days of suffering and torment, must be released unconditionally and returned to their distraught families.
I'm joined now by John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, the largest network of Israeli and Palestinian peace builders.
We've taken over 50 of those peace builders to Washington this week, together, Israelis, Palestinians, their allies from North America, meeting members of Congress from both parties, meeting the Biden administration, USAID, the State Department, the White House, and really taking that message together, Israelis and Palestinians, their joint call for peace and equality and the need for really meaningful diplomacy to end the conflict. And I'm biased, but it was incredibly powerful. Just so many members of Congress and their staff remarked about how unusual it was to have Israelis and Palestinians together in their offices calling for the same thing in this incredibly polarized moment. And we were also joined by Israelis and Palestinians whose lives have been torn apart by this war, by people like Yonatan Zagin, whose mother, Vivian Silver, was murdered on October 7th. She was like a leading activist at OLMEP and several of our members. Magen Inon, two of his parents were killed on October 7th as well. Kamal Al-Mashrawi, who's an alumni from one of our members from Gaza, who went through a huge ordeal with his family trying to escape from the Gaza Strip, moving around, displaced. And having those personal stories, I think, really impacted policymakers that we met. But I think also, again, that power of them saying, look, we're both Israelis and Palestinians. We've paid the ultimate price for this war. Here's what we want you as policymakers to do, to get behind us, to end this war, but also to put civil society peace builders like us at the center of your planning and really build from the bottom up the kind of capacity and roots that real conflict resolution will need. So I hope the message landed. I think we'll wait and see.
And speaking of peace, it doesn't look too hopeful for any sort of ceasefire, hostage release negotiation happening, at least not before the start of the Ramadan holy month on Sunday. But it sounds like they're willing to come back to the table. I'm just wondering if you see it as could potentially heighten tensions if there are continued attacks in Gaza during Ramadan.
Yes. I mean, first of all, on the negotiations themselves, it's possible there's some last-minute brinkmanship. We've seen that before in previous Israel-Gaza wars where, you know, each side sort of is jockeying for position at the last minute. We know there's delegations and their envoys in Cairo having discussions. I'm not optimistic, to be very honest, but it's not impossible that this is sort of some last-minute brinkmanship. And for the very reason you point out, we know already that, you know, Ramadan is a flashpoint whenever there is heightened tensions in Israel-Palestine, and we've never had tensions as heightened as those that we see right now. And so the idea of this level of violence continuing over the course of that month with all of the sensitivity, not just on the Israel-Gaza track, which obviously day-to-day is continuing to produce so much carnage, but also in Jerusalem, which is the flashpoint, the sort of epicenter of this conflict. There's a lot of tensions focused around Al-Aqsa Mosque and access for Palestinian pilgrims who want to come and pray there during the holy month, being very much weaponized and politicized by extreme Israeli politicians such as Minister for Security Itamar Ben-Gvir. And then the situation on the West Bank as well. I was there a few weeks ago. It's really at breaking point. A lot of economic hardship. Palestinian workers haven't been able to enter Israel since October 7th. There is a lot of issues with economic impact of that. And Ramadan tends to be a time when families expect to be able to have, you know, a few extra shekels to purchase iftar meals and gifts and be able to see family members. And that sort of economic hardship at this time of year produces real strains, as well as the access. So when I was in the West Bank, there's checkpoints between most major cities now, and it took 5 hours for a colleague of mine to get from Bethlehem to Ramallah. So all of those things, I think, together over the duration of a month create huge, huge worries. And that's without even getting into the possibility of a Rafah operation during Ramadan, which would be devastating.
Israel apparently did not send a delegation to the negotiations. And it sounds like they're still very far apart, given that Hamas wants an agreement to completely end this. And Israel just wants something temporary, and they want the name of the hostages and their conditions before agreeing anything. But it seems like a pretty tough battle to get through those things that they're so dug into.
Yeah, I mean, so the Israelis demanded a list of the remaining hostages who are still alive in Gaza. the reports that Hamas responded with is that we would need a short temporary ceasefire in order to actually produce that list, because it's impossible under current conditions for them to essentially like audit the number of hostages who remain alive. I mean, it's very difficult for us to know the veracity of this from a distance, but it shouldn't seem insurmountable if the political will is there to actually reach the ceasefire. And I think one of my worries is that both Hamas and Israel, or at least forces within the Israeli government, wonder whether there is more political utility in either extending this brinksmanship or potentially not having a temporary ceasefire at all. We know that for the last round of significant discussions in Cairo, Israel didn't agree to send a delegation till the very, very last minute, so the Friday morning of the meeting itself, under duress, we understand, from the Biden administration to do that. And, you know, this is an uncomfortable point, but there is a political dimension to this too, in that a lot of political analysts in Israel observe that there is a political interest for the prime minister to extend the war as long as possible. And, you know, these are not ideal incentives you would like political leaders to have in the midst of the worst war that Israel has ever seen. And also from Hamas's perspective, this is very, very grisly, but I think there are some people in and around Hamas who believe that extending this war as long as possible, which introduces pressure on Israel and the international stage and delegitimization, is in their long-term interest. And of course, the people who pay the price for those sort of cynical political calculations are the civilian population of Gaza, who have been devastated, and the hostages. It's really hard to understand what sort of ordeal they're now facing 5 months into being held hostage in a war zone. And, you know, and that whole calculation I just sketched out, I mean, it's dehumanizing, right? It's not putting the victims and the people who are most vulnerable in this war at the forefront of calculations, instead looking at political or geostrategic interests instead. And I really hope that the Biden administration and other international actors are doing everything they can to exert pressure on both parties. It's important. Both Hamas and the Israeli government need to be induced to reach this deal.
As you said, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu may have political reasons for wanting to extend this war, but the capital that Israel had from the deep sorrow around the world as to what happened on October 7th, now there is world outrage over what we're seeing on the humanitarian side and what innocent Palestinians are having to endure.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of observations around that. I mean, the first is that none of this should be a game about the popularity or support of a party in a war. And I feel like there's partisans on either side that are treating it that way. Which side is most popular or most sympathized with in the court of public opinion? That's a very dangerous dynamic to get into, where suddenly casualties and loss and tragedy get turned into some sort of an asset rather than a liability. I'd really, really warn all of us not to fall into that dynamic. And I think it's unfortunately something that's very typical of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from those far away from it, where it seems sometimes like a game, for want of a better word, and a debate rather than the lives of millions and millions of Israelis and Palestinians. The second observation on this, our founder, Avi Meierstein, just wrote a piece that was published in Hebrew, Arabic, and English in Al-Quds, a Palestinian national newspaper, that covered this idea, is that both Israelis and Palestinians, I mean, they observe what you've just said. For Israelis, they saw the worldwide sympathy in the aftermath of October 7th and then saw it slide away relatively quickly and didn't understand why. And for Palestinians, they saw sympathies internationally only begin to increase over time. And the reason for this is that both Palestinians and Israelis are only seeing half of the tragedy that we've observed over the last 5 months. I mean, when I was in Israel, it's very hard to find news and images and footage of the devastation, the humanitarian catastrophe in the Gaza Strip. You have to really seek it out. And equally in Palestinian society, there's been very little reporting of the terrible crimes committed on October 7th as well. So the actual parties to the conflict are themselves only really understanding half of the dynamic. And that in itself produces really bad political incentives and dynamics within both societies. It's on us internationally, with the privilege of being able to see what's happening both in Gaza and what took place in Israel on October 7th, to really try and maintain as objective an analysis as possible and to be focused on the result of trying to end this war rather than supporting one side over the other and waving a flag. And we should be very careful not to lose sight of that.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, we always appreciate speaking with you.
Thank you, Laurie.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Laurie London. Turning now to the climate crisis. The world's oceans reached record temperatures in February, according to the European Union's climate change agency, Copernicus. University of Reading climate scientist Akshay Dioris.
We are having the three major oceans of the world, the Pacific, the Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean, you know, working in symphony to produce this massive spike in the sea surface temperature. And this is also concerning because even if you look at the Arctic Ocean, and for February 2024, it was also really hot.
Joining us is Jen Koss, Coral Reef Conservation Program Director with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who says their scientists are concerned the world could be on the cusp of a fourth mass coral reef bleaching event. Thank you for being with us. Can you explain what this means?
The world is experiencing mass conditions that are ripe for corals to bleach. And that puts a lot of stress on coral reef ecosystems. During bleaching events, you do see mortality, but in some cases, you actually see corals can come through the bleaching event and survive. So what that means for us is we need to verify that it's happening and up our monitoring to figure out what the fate is of corals that are experiencing these conditions, and then figure out the trajectory of corals that do recover. How are they doing in the long run? And at the same time, we're doing a lot of amazing things to make sure that we are restoring corals that are resilient to these temperatures. We're looking at ecosystem scale restoration of multiple species. Not all species react the same way to coral bleaching. So it's not a good announcement to make, but it's not all doom and gloom either.
What are the impacts of the demise of coral reefs?
You know, when you have mass mortality, it really impacts the entire ecosystem and all of the associated critters that live there. So you can see shifts in the populations of fish. You'll see algae come in and take over the structure if the coral dies. So you really see phase shifts in the way that the ecosystem functions, and lost biodiversity, lost coral protection of shorelines. So that's why we're doing our utmost to make sure that we are helping managers to take actions during bleaching events. For instance, in the Florida Keys, we were able to move some coral nurseries into more protected, colder waters, or move really vulnerable species on land into aquaria to protect them, to make sure that we didn't lose them. So we're really trying to provide a lot of information so that if managers are able to take actions, they know exactly when and where to take those actions.
If coral reefs don't exist, what about the rest of the species and life in the ocean?
The ones that can move to other habitats, they will. If corals 100% were to go extinct, you'd see some pretty huge impacts in the oceans, just like if we were to see polar regions go completely extinct. You'd see some large-scale ocean changes. But again, we're not ready to say that that's happening. Corals are under stress, but we are not calling for the complete extermination of corals on the globe. They're remarkably resilient.
What's the outlook if the planet continues to see record heat?
There are predictions out there in the literature that if we continue to act as we are now with respect to emitting greenhouse gases, that the trajectory is that we will sort of functionally lose corals maybe by 2100. Some people are estimating that that might be sooner. I think what we're really trying to do is we know that that trajectory is happening. And obviously the best thing that could possibly be done is for us to really grapple with greenhouse gases and get the entire world to come to a more reasonable accommodation of what we're doing. But even if we were to stop all emissions today, it's going to take a while for the ocean to come back to its normal equilibrium. So we know that ocean conditions are going to change. So we tried to get ahead of that and commissioned a study with the National Academies on what are the interventions for coral reefs that are most likely to yield positive results. So corals exist around the world in different conditions. In the Red Sea, those corals are much better adapted to warmer temperatures than corals, let's say, in the Gulf of Mexico. And so can we use those resilient properties of those corals and breed corals that can be put into places where the water's getting warmer? We're doing everything we can to make sure that corals persist throughout a changing ocean and eventually get to the point where they've reached an equilibrium and start to thrive again. It's really too big to fail at this point. We've got too much invested in the world, is too much reliant on the ecosystem services of coral reefs just to throw up our hands and say we're done. This isn't a single species. We're talking about an entire ecosystem and people's ways of life, their homes, their livelihoods, their infrastructure.
Meaning if the ocean's warm, it will impact all of us.
It's already impacting human lives. There are coral nations. Kiribati is about, you know, a meter or so above sea level. So as conditions warm You see lots of sea life and these protective structures that are necessary to keep the islands in place that are largely sand islands. I mean, we're already seeing those impacts. It's can we slow it down and can we reverse the trajectory?
Jen Koss, Coral Reef Conservation Program Director with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you so much for speaking with us. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.